Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's a little after midnight on the 16th of January 2021. I spent the evening making some notes based on two or three long conversations that Anna and myself have had over the last few days as we've been chewing the fat over breakfast and walking round the hill at the back of the town. And we find ourselves concerned with what you might call the question of hope. Is there actually any hope in this current moment, given that there seem so many negative things going on in the world? And we've also found ourselves in that context, really wanting a more refined idea than hope, which seems to be something that can be sort of quite unfounded, you know, or unrealistic. And it's led us in various ways into thinking about the pain that is at large in the world, pretty well unequivocally, and the trauma that's circulating in many countries, particularly given COVID, not only for its public health impacts and the death that it's dealing around the place, but also the economic damage that it's inflicting on already fragile economies. So I've called it tentatively On Collective Pain and Its Outcomes and the General Question of Hope. Here we go then. We live in a time of mass anger, resentment and depression. Indeed, a whole complex tangle of pain inflicts very many people in myriad ways. Why? Before I answer, I want to say that this characterisation applies to most of the world. But to keep this talk manageable, I'm going to confine my remarks to the UK, with just a few mentions of the US situation where relevant. Firstly, some historical context. 12 years of austerity and the accompanying economic fragility are still taking their toll. The 2008 financial crash was a pivotal moment. Outsourcing and deindustrialisation have led to massive precariousness for working people. Wages have stagnated in real terms since 2008, in fact, since before then. Many public services have been cut, from public libraries to the number of nurses employed in the health service. Higher education, once free, has become increasingly expensive, with tuition fees for humanities BAs being a bit over 9k per year and medical degrees weighing in at 38k per year. This sorry situation has its roots in the economic philosophies. And I put economic philosophies in inverted commas, because philosophically these things are pretty thin. This sorry situation has its roots in the economic philosophies of Hayek, Buchanan, Friedman and others, and their influence on Conservative Prime Minister Thatcher, who was Prime Minister of the UK between 1979 and 1990, and Republican US President Ronald Reagan, who served between 81 and 89. Both of these leaders were pretty right-wing by any standard, but supposedly progressive leaders, inverted commas, like Bill Clinton, Democratic president from 93 to 2001, and UK Labour Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister between 97 and 2007, were not immune to the charms of this philosophy either. The proselytising effort of the ideologues of this view were often paid for by big oligarchical money. Think, for example, of the Koch brothers' big oil financing of right-wing think tanks and US university economics departments. The politicians whose role it was to actualise this philosophy were backed by billionaire-owned right-wing media. Think of the mutual wooing of Tony Blair and Rupert Murdoch, which most certainly gained the former the UK premiership. I'm talking about neoliberalism, of course. We need to understand a few things about this philosophy, inverted commas. Firstly, neoliberalism was a class project from the outset. It was a manoeuvre in a class war. It was an ideological narrative and utopian value scheme intended to support and enable the most rich and powerful global capitalists. As ideology, it was and remains all surface. Its ideals, free markets and small government and so on, have never been realised and never will be realised. Governments remain big, but in virtue of massive entanglement with global corporations, a nexus of corporate governmental power was consolidated. As for free markets, government intervention in the economy, particularly in markets, at times has been on a vast scale. Note the bailout of the banks after 2008 and the constant feed of quantitative easing money to corporations ever since, intensifying at this time of global pandemic and lockdown measures to the extent that the 10 richest people in the world have increased their personal fortunes over the last 10 months of the pandemic by $400 billion, which is 296 billion Great Britain pounds. Neoliberalism is the cover story that conceals the corporate command economy whilst legitimating the freedom to exploit workers and to move capital freely around the world. I'll put freedom in inverted commas. They talk a very big freedom talk, these lot, but it's very selective to whom it applies. Meanwhile, the working class are encouraged by the billionaire-owned media to espouse individualism. Mrs. Thatcher's quote, "There is no such thing as society," end quote, and to embrace ethno-nationalism. By contrast, the masters of this universe, the rich and powerful 0.1%, the inhabitants of Richistan, are good cosmopolitans and free-floating, geographically speaking. When the class nature of the neoliberal project is understood, you can see why both Reagan and Thatcher went in for union busting, both through direct confrontation and through introducing legal constraints on workers' self-organisation. And many of those constraints haven't been rolled back since that time. So that was a freedom that could not be allowed, thereby exposing the ideological propaganda nature of the neoliberal freedom talk. Think in this context of the bitter year-long miners' strike in the UK of 1984 to 1985, where the much-vaunted freedom of the neoliberal ideologues was encouraged was in the deregulation of the fire sector, culminating in Clinton's 99 repeal of the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which had been instituted to control the stock market gambling that had crashed the global economy in 1929. Basically, what that act did was to separate the banks, high street retail business from its investment business and speculative business. The resulting excesses, particularly the institution of complex instruments to package fragments of subprime mortgages, for example, collateralised debt obligations or CDOs, was bound to go tits up. And indeed, it did lead to the catastrophic 2008 crash. The subsequent ideology contravening government intervention in the markets, the bailing out of the banks, was what it took to keep some semblance of an economy going at all. In the wake of the crash, many people in the US lost their homes. By many, I mean millions. Between 2006 and 2014, 10 million families lost their homes to repossession because of this subprime mortgage crash. Wages have remained stagnant since, in real terms, And the labour market has been made even more precarious, with union membership and influence pathetically low in both the UK and the US. Social problems, mental health consequences, and general anomie and alienation have also been consequences. At this point, let's factor in the COVID pandemic that has raged around the world for the last 10 months or so. At the time of this podcast, COVID-19 has killed over 2 million people worldwide. When the pandemic eventually subsides, there will be many more people than is usual in grief. Many will see that they have been lied to and that the Tory government has massively mismanaged the emergency from the point of view of public health. Though, from the point of view of big capital, it has done very well by directing vast amounts of public money via private contracts in accord with its private's best philosophy and outsourcing modality into the pockets of its corporate donors and its real, not apparent, political constituency. I've already mentioned the increasing wealth of some of the wealthiest global oligarchs. Our local UK members of this class, inasmuch as they are local, have done very well, thanks to their pals in the Tory party, who they sustain in power with donations and media support. This, while the economy has taken an 8% hit in the last year, and there is much desperate poverty amongst the working class. Here's a very recent example from amongst many of the above-mentioned corruption. It concerns the matter of free school meals. In case you've been sleeping under a rock, here's the story. The Tory government U-turned on its policy of not supplying free school lunches to pupils during lockdown school closures, under massive public pressure, spearheaded by the famous young footballer Marcus Rashford. True to its ideological commitment to outsourcing government activities to private corporations, the meals were to be supplied by a company called Chartwells, a member of the Compass Group. This is a $75 billion per annum corporation. Billion, not million. Its CEO is one Dominic Blakemore, whose salary is reported to be £4.7 million per annum. Incidentally, this guy is a big donor to the Tory party. The meals contract is worth £350 million per annum, as far as I can ascertain. Keep those amounts of money in your mind as you contemplate the fact that this company has been charging £30 for meals worth £5 or less. Thankfully, a huge scandal ensued when this came to light. Photos of the pathetic meals went viral on social media, which made it apparent to many, many people, that public money, their money, was being scammed as children were going hungry. Even the gutter press and TV channels, generally pro-establishment, joining in the furore, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson was obliged to appear contrite. Yet without admitting cronyism at Prime Minister's questions on the 13th of January 2021. So that's this week. It fell to Marcus Rashford once again to act as a real opposition by intervening directly with the Prime Minister. What is this? It's actually, as far as I can see, a breakthrough of the simple adequationist truth. Through the hard wall of disinformation, otherising propaganda, divide and rule manipulation, confusing conspiracy theories, distraction, algorithmic selection and bubble formation that is par for the course in both mainstream media and social media. Here we see social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc., actually being useful. Though we have to keep in mind that these media are owned and controlled by the huge tech companies, which have a track record of manipulation of the public as a central part of its business model. After all, They sell advertising and data that the users supply them with to make their massive profits and maximise their stock price. Data is indeed gold. Nevertheless, every stick has two ends. Though Facebook delivered us up to Trump and Brexit, we too can play the game if we are alert and find and make spaces on the internet to share ideas and build community locally and globally and promote and coordinate activism. Once again, we see the battle to control information and the stories that people live by. Understanding even a little of how this works illuminates the necessity for a people's internet, for new left media that can reach far and wide with rigorous analysis, interpretation, evaluation and comment. Platforms that can't be taken down as they inflame establishment and oligarchical paranoia, purposed for activist coordination. This is already happening, though perhaps not fast enough. As traditional print media face their demise and the demographics are not on their side, shoestring budgets and crowdfunding are helping to build numerous good news and comment channels run by folks who know that business as usual is not an option. However, the right has not failed to notice this loss of ground for their traditional media propagandists, just as insightful and busy leftists are informing a growing audience. Consequently, the UK is to get a far-right Fox News type 24-hour TV channel with lots of billionaire money behind it. Andrew Neil, the chair of the right-wing journal The Spectator, will front GB News. It will operate under Ofcom rules of a, quote, due impartiality, and makes claims to balance in its blurb. But these constraints are really quite flabby, if not downright empty, if BBC propagandist coverage of, say, the Corbyn project is considered. Rupert Murdoch is planning something similar with his News UK, and don't expect it to be anywhere to the left of Genghis Khan. Now, let's factor in Tory Brexit, which we are now in the midst of. Even fans of this move by the UK, if they are informed and honest, have to admit that the economy will take a considerable hit as a result of the UK leaving the EU. This is certainly the view of a wide range of economists. That hit will compound the economic contraction already caused by the pandemic, and until the pandemic settles down, will continue to do so. Bankruptcies and migration of firms will continue, and consequently unemployment will rise in the short term. In the long term, unless there is effective pushback, the labour market will be further stripped of workers' protections and rights, and jobs further rendered precarious. This is the Singapore model the ERG so love. They hope, somewhat logically, I think, to attract overseas investment with a pool of cheap, unregulated labour, which is nevertheless well-educated, yet usefully rendered docile by debt. So, this is the background of the widespread pain roughly sketched. All aspects of life are swimming in a sewer of propaganda, falsehood, paranoia and pain-driven myth in the bigger context of environmental degradation, dangerous geopolitical instabilities and local cultural fragmentation marked by highly charged and divisive antagonisms. Leavers, Remainers, MAGAs and Libtards, etc., etc. In the light of this picture, can we discern in a more nuanced fashion the pains we remarked upon somewhat vaguely at the outset of this investigation? And what do they give rise to? Firstly, economic deprivation as union representation and bargaining have been gutted over the past 40 years, and as industrial areas have lost jobs due to offshoring, have resulted in depression, both individual and collective, and decline of communities. This is especially true of communities relying on one industrial enterprise. Mining villages in the UK went through this when Mrs. Thatcher closed down mining of coal, certainly, in the UK, and smashed the miners' union in the process. This is serious and tragic for the communities concerned, as the fabric of community life frays and interpersonal connections suffers in the midst of real poverty. The conviviality, which is a big and vital part of the richness of life, takes a hit. Anxiety about income, worrying about feeding the kids, despairing of ever having a future, easily become mental illness. This subterranean grumble that has been a feature of UK working class life in many areas has been compounded by both Brexit and the COVID pandemic, to the extent that it is now loud and right up at the surface. The news is preoccupied of late with the rise in mental illness, either caused by isolation, enforced idleness, or work stress. The latter is being reported extensively in relation to healthcare professionals who are dealing with the catastrophic strain the pandemic is placing on the NHS, already weakened by Tory cuts and outsourcing policies. Another consequence that is hitting the news is the increase of intrafamilial abuse for other obvious reasons. I'll just mention that we predicted all this on day one of the first lockdown. It's reasonable to expect widespread impotent anger at having been lied to about both COVID and Brexit in the context of an already failing economy, and layered onto anxiety and depression. Now, just to clarify, I'm not claiming that lockdown wasn't necessary. It seems to me it should have been more rigorous in the manner of New Zealand or Vietnam right at the outset. We also expect resentment on the part of many at being powerless to a high degree. We do make this point repeatedly, appealing to the big picture. It goes like this, just to remind you. The neo-fascist trickle-up economic system gives rise to gross inequalities of wealth and power, which leads to vast numbers of people being rendered nearly powerless in respect of their own lives. This is perhaps the most damaging and dangerous of the manifestations of alienation and bad feeling and resentment. Meaninglessness features largely in the landscape that opens up here too. This is very dangerous to society, communities, families and individuals. How so? These feelings can be, and are, captured and weaponized by dark political forces that ultimately would preserve and enhance the interests of the already rich and powerful. The motive behind this capture is not always obvious. Usually it is claimed that some cause other than oligarchical power is being pursued. We hear the good of the nation, or the sunlit uplands in the future, for the sake of which we sacrifice now, or the like. The superficial stated causes, however, are merely camouflage, though they do have capturing power, simply because having a cause supplies meaning, when formerly and very painfully there was none. This is how the harebrained Brexit agenda won the day, by capturing and directing the free-floating alienation, resentment, anger at large in society, and supplying a spurious explanation for it, a meaning if you like, and a possible cure for it. Further, reality didn't enter the game. Similarly, this ploy is what Trump employed. All of this is emotionally charged, since it is deep psychological pain that is being mobilised. Otherisation is of great use in this project. And we mention this frequently, and I'm sure I've gone into it in previous podcasts. So what is otherisation? An external other, an enemy, real or imagined, is a wonderful focus for the rage and resentment, rendering it useless for such dangers as socialism, egalitarianism, or empathy and compassion. Hence, and now I'm going to make a list, hence the Turks are at the gate of Vienna. Rapey Mexicans are clawing at the wall. Travellers need legislating against, and this has happened recently and really in the UK. Immigrants are deported, a spectacle. Poverty porn, vilification of the underclass, the new undeserving poor. It served the Victorian capitalists well. Why reinvent the wheel? Gypsies, Jews, communists, all are grist to the mill of the oligarchs, propagandists, and cruel functionaries. Again, none of this is based in truth. All of it is leading to disaster. The functionaries of this game, who do quite nicely out of it, are still promoting big oil, hierarchical societies, business as usual. They are busy intensifying divide and rule amongst the people, just in case they get it, that they are unstoppable en masse and acting with one accord, as they did in 1789 and 1917. This divide and rule strategy lights upon any cultural difference the propagandists can find, turning it into a darkly passionate schism. Pathological violence sits ugly at the heart of this game, and we have seen it recently, on quite a few occasions, right up close. Anna often asks me, is there any hope? I often reply along these lines. There are signs that should encourage optimism of the will, though alongside it there must be pessimism of the intellect. In other words, our analysis needs to be sharp. It must entail a cold, hard look at things. Psychological, economic, ecological, cultural. A vision undistorted by the temptation to wishful thinking and self-calming. At the same time, we need to be assured both by history and the sense of our own strength and the probity of our own analysis that the human enterprise can move forward. Here are a few encouraging signs. The UK teachers' unions caused the Tory government to do a U-turn on school opening during the pandemic lockdown. They hold a meeting online of 400,000 members. They increased their membership by over 100,000 in the process. A fairly new cleaners' union in the US goes international and has huge membership uptake. In the UK, the Independent Workers' Union discovers that precariat workers can be unionised to good effect. In the US, even Google workers successfully unionise, having set up the preliminaries secretly. Meanwhile, in India, the world's biggest general strike occurs involving 250 million workers, at the same time as farmers protest en masse against government actions damaging to their prosperity and working conditions, which are in fact cronyist manoeuvres by the government. There is more, much more, but I'll finish by mentioning the rise of some necessary grassroots organisations and suggest you check at least one of them out. Extinction Rebellion, Corbyn's Peace and Justice Movement, newly started up, which will be having its inaugural meeting online next week, I think, or at the weekend. Yanis Varoufakis' Europe-wide DiEM25, Black Lives Matter, of course. And there are many more. Electoral politics alone will not do the job of shifting the delusion that business as usual is an option, and putting in its place both a vision and a set of powerful pragmatics. Massive grassroots support for a radical party with parliamentary power will help the parliamentarians to do the necessary restructuring of the state and the economy and the now unviable social settlement. It will also punish the party if they welch on the project, as so often happens. This is why we need the grassroots active. Otherwise, the oligarchs' government will win again, whoever gets in formally. Thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of that. Particular thanks to the patrons who just bung us a few quid, which keeps this ticking over. And lots of love. Be careful out there. Make knowledge great again.